lipstick reflex got me wound. There were no defects to be found.
Good morning, everyone. We hope you're having a great day thus far. We hope we can accompany you with your morning joe, your OJ, or possibly your English tea, maybe a bagel with a schmear or a scone, or possibly a croissant. Well, this is our new morning program, and we hope you're enjoying it with your breakfast, healthy or unhealthy, whatever you like. Anyway, this is your community radio station. You are tuned to WOWDLP Tacoma Park, 94.3 on your FM station. This is Tom Xenakis, and I'm with Sheila Blake, and we are the hosts of the Artist Experience radio show. We hope you're enjoying our previous programming.
Hi, this is Sheila.
Your morning voice.
In my morning voice, which is barely operating right now, but we'll do it. Anyway, good morning, everybody. So this is the Artist Experience, an hour radio show dedicated to looking at art. We hope Tom and I can introduce our listeners to what we've been looking at and help the viewer, when they visit the exhibit, create in their soul, in their experience, their own work of art. That's the purpose here. We also have an Artist Experience Facebook page where we put images of things we're talking about, and we really hope you will look at those images while you're listening to our show, because it's really, they tell you so much. And you can also stream this program at tacomaradio.org. And also, we're putting podcasts of this show on my website, SheilaBlake.com, so that you can listen at any time. We at WOWDLP Tacoma Park are always looking to improve our community radio station. This is our first Saturday morning show, so we invite you to start your mornings and hear about art and culture with your morning coffee. And there we go.
Yeah, we need to say that twice, actually. Yes. Get everybody going
here. Yeah, I got mine.
Like, there's a new exhibition at the National Gallery of Art on the Mall in the West Wing. It just opened. And this exhibition provides a generous offering of portrait photography from the Robert Menschel collection. And we're going to title this show, The Power of the Portrait in Photography. We entertained a program on jazz portraits a long while ago, but we wanted to zero in on the wonderful overview of the portrait in photography. And this exhibition is titled Posing for the Camera. Works by Robert Menschel Collection is gifted to the National Gallery of Art. You know, I could not help think about the selfie and the sense of posing as I was walking into the museum. And would you have it, there was a tourist right there in front of the National Gallery of Art taking a selfie. She had this adorable grin on her face. And I was saying to myself, I hope I'm not going to get subjected to any more selfies in this gallery. I'll just die there. I mean, But I saved my energy, and I went to this small and enjoyable exhibition that goes on through January 28, 2018. So I have plenty of time to go see it. And it's a really sweet show with incredible portrait photographs.
Mm. Well, this exhibition is a generous contribution from the collection of photographs by Robert Menschel. He's a collector and supporter of photography. He is a philanthropist to the arts. He's a director at Goldman Sachs and on the board of trustees at MoMA. He cares deeply about photography, has a great collection, and he also gives money to the Whitney, to other art venues like the Apollo Theater in Carnegie Hall and the Philharmonic in New York City. And he gave support and legitimacy to artists who were sort of not well-known but experimental, photographers like Harry Callahan and Aaron Susskind.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it
wow.
really is. Like, he really did give them the support they needed to continue their work.
Mm.
And they're in the show also, some of their work. So even though this is a really modest show, the pictures are small, and each one is like a touchstone in the history of photography. The first picture is from 1839.
Wow, so it really goes back to the
very,
original
very
roots
beginning.
Of photography.
Yeah, it really does.
That's an amazing thing, mm-hmm. and actually the years that he covers in this exhibition is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd like to just talk a little about the power of the portrait. What about that portrait? Why is it so visually powerful in the history of art in general? And then outside even of photography, because it starts way before the middle of the 1800s when photography is taking shape. And so I wanted to just talk about why the portrait has enamored so many people in the history of the world. And firstly, portraits are really about visualizing people who are in charge. It's about wealth, it's about power and prestige. And in some ways, this exhibition changes that when people get the whole of the camera in middle class Europe, and it spreads, of course, to America. And then the portraits are about preserving and documenting a legacy of someone in history or in a moment of time, whether it be an ancient ruler or possibly a sense of an army general, so on and so forth. And the other thing is, portraits are about currency. What is important now? Usually, you turn the newspaper, there's a portrait of somebody that's important now. So sometimes the portrait kind of indicates the things that are happening at the time. And also, I have to also explain that, it's also about currency in the sense of money. Many times portraits are on, money and currency. And, you can go in the middle of the Mongolian desert, Sheila, and you can find a nomad, and he's going to, take out of his wallet or his case, he's going to take out some American greenbacks, and he's going to know Lincoln, Washington, possibly Franklin, possibly Grant, and he's having a good day. So the portrait is about
good.
Money as well. And
like
then
that.
And then there's the portrait actually has a significant role in the history of religions and spiritualities. There's a quote from the Bible, which we all might remember, render unto Caesars that which are Caesar's. That's about the picture of Caesar on a coin.
Uh-huh.
And it's a mockery of Caesar's, power, of course, from, the biblical story in Jesus Christ. But it's a kind of, again, it's about a portrait. It's about that face that Caesar had the audacity of putting on a coin. But then we have also images outside of that particular legacy in Buddha and Krishna and other ancient pagan and non-pagan a religion. So it plays an important role. And the portrait is also, and this is the thing that we really need to address today, it's about maintaining the continuity of emotions after a person that might have left us, either physically, emotionally, psychologically, or spiritually. And I think that's one of the powers of this exhibition for me. And the portrait plays a huge role in history, and many artists that have taken before the, not only before the invention of the camera, but the portrait came first in drawing and painting and was the visual precedence for these guys running around with this heavy, newly invented camera. And then in the exhibition, it's very clear that the older genres, like painting and drawing, were valuable tools to help the photographer pose the subject. And, of course, that's the title of the exhibition, Posing for the Camera.
Well, I wanted to say right at the outset that they're not all portraits in this exhibition. And the first photograph is by William Henry Fox Talbot. And it's a cloister at the Lacock Abbey. And it was done in 1845. And what's really surprising about it is that it's really it's an attempt to me to be a painting. It's the values are very controlled. Every leaf is clear. And it's like an experiment of what you can do with the camera that you might not be able to do in a painting, where you can't do all those thin leaves and things. And the best, the thing that's really interesting, it's all about the texture of the abbey and the texture of the foliage. And the best comparison I could make is the Monet-Rouen cathedrals, the facades of those cathedrals, which are all about light and texture, just as this is. And they didn't happen until 50 years later, really.
Right.
So not the first photographs were often to document foreign lands and exotic people and places. People went to the deserts and photographed camels. But then later, when they invented the daguerreotype, people could afford to take portraits of themselves, for themselves, and for their families. So photography studios opened up.
It got commercial.
It did. And it got affordable too.
Right.
So what were those portraits for mostly? I have portraits of my ancestors. Ooh, it's not a pretty bunch.
Oh, come on, Sheila. Be nice.
I have them.
It's a morning show. Come on.
and why did they have them taken? For marriages, for christenings, and for deaths.
Things haven't changed, in other words.
No. Well, these are all my ancestors. They're a long time ago here. But I wanted to talk about this, that once when I was visiting my son who teaches school in central Wisconsin, I got up very early on a Sunday morning to work on a drawing. And eventually the church bell started ringing, and otherwise it was entirely quiet. So then when everyone woke up, I said, you know, this is the kind of place that a guy could just walk out in his backyard and blow his brains out. It was so desolate, even though it was a town. And my son said that just happened last week. The guy who owned the art store did that, the art supply store.
Goodness.
And it just felt like that. So then I came across a book, and it's called Wisconsin Death Trip by Michael Lessie. And what this is that in 1970, a cache of about 30,000 glass photographic plates were found, and they had been stored in a photographer's studio. And they had been made during 20 years at the turn of the century when the country was struck by a diphtheria epidemic, and all the jobs were gone, the mining jobs and the lumber jobs, and people were just walking around in a daze. They had nothing, they had no hope. It was, and so this photographer worked with the Badger State Banner newspaper, the local newspaper, to put announcements. A lot of the announcements were death, and the photographer photographed a lot of people in death, and it's really so profound. It really is that these people, they just had, it's a record of that
of the
they
times.
Lived.
Yeah, of the, just sadly, that particular time was documented.
It is.
By this particular photographer. Wow.
So the introduction to that book, I think, can help serve as an introduction to this experience of looking at these photographs. And so I wanted to read to you a kind of combination of what I have written and what the Michael Lessie said. These pictures are an exercise in historical actuality, but it has only as much to do with history as the light that makes it visible on the retina of your eye. It is as much an experiment of alchemy as an exercise of history. Its primary intention is to make you experience the photographs as a flexible mirror that turned one way can reflect the odor of the air when these plates were discovered. If turned another, it can project your anticipations of next Monday. If turned around again, it can transmit the sound of breathing in the deep winter air of a room of 120 years ago. And this time turned backward can itself fuse all three images. And so you can focus on what you might be, what may have happened, all upon a single point of your imagination and transform them like light focused by a lens on paper from a lower form of energy to a higher.
Wow, that kind of puts it in a perspective of what photography does.
It really does, because I wanted
technically
to really
too. Yeah.
Talk about the profundity of these photographs, which you could easily walk in this room and leave in 10 minutes having sort of just like, you know, sort of viewed, oh yeah, these are small photographs. But when you really look at them, really think about them, this leads you in, I think.
Oh yeah, for sure, in this exhibition.
Yeah. So, in the early days of the daguerreotype, which was the photographs that were made on glass plates, there was no depth of field, just the person with a neutral background. And what an amazing array of faces in this exhibit. Yeah. There's a whole just
case
of these small photographs. And I tell you, if you took a crowd of people off the street and took their photographs, you would not get these kind of people, the homeliness of them and the dignity of them. And they're like, you would not see these people on the street today.
Yeah, it kind of puts them in a time warp. They're like frozen in time, mm-hmm. in these photos, those daguerreotypes.
Mm-hmm. And then I also put some pictures on the Artist Experience website of early American portraiture, because, oy vey, try as they must, no artist could get a likeness like the camera could. And there are pictures of babies and an artist could soften mouths and put brightness in the eyes of what might be dull eyes, but the camera could get the minutest detail. They get a perfect likeness. So I think that the early photographers had great instructions of the master painters of what works for a lovely portrait. There's a kind of, they got the lessons of portraiture, the light coming often from the right down to the left, half of the face in shadow, half in light, and the little glint of the light on maybe the glasses or a piece of jewelry. And oftentimes the men were posed with a dark jacket and a white shirt, so that the white shirt and maybe a glove or hand at the breast that could really make the composition of the photographs. And so the photographers learned from that how to do that.
Yeah, they were taking lessons from visual arts in general.
Yes.
And all the principles of composition, what makes something beautiful, what makes something right and good. So I think, yeah, that's very clear. And that's good to point out for, beginning art appreciators to see that in the photos. That they're well done in that sense.
Yes,
it's just
they
not
are.
A snap of the camera like we do with
exactly.
the selfie.
They are portraits, and they have that kind of monumental impact, no matter how small they are. They have a kind of a monumental quality to them. And I know we've talked about this before, but artists' use of lenses as far back as the 17th century, which is was conveniently undocumented until David Hockney, the British artist, disclosed his findings about the use of lenses in painters early, like Vermeer. Well, some of this we really know, and it is documented, and still there's a sense that the artists were cheating. And but in the painters of this time, like Degas and William Merritt Chase, then they were very clear about using photographs. How could Degas talk about how could he paint horses that were trotting in the field if he didn't use photographs?
Absolutely, yeah. No, he was one of the first proponents of the camera. Mm-hmm. And it certainly wasn't cheating for him.
No.
But it was for a lot of other artists of the time. even in our period, sometimes they said we were cheating if you were using
photography. They do say that, but I'm always about fighting that idea. And not just Degas, but like Bonnard took many, many photographs of his family and his gardens and himself and Marta. He was quite the exhibitionist, actually.
Oh, really?
Yes, remember, it's a morning show, Sheila.
It's a morning show. Let's stick with the program. I'm only kidding.
And then the French painter, Caillebotte, he used photographs as a kind of scientific research of what the camera could do for painting. And sometimes it is just so weird. The distortions are totally weird because the camera distorts in its own way.
Sure.
It flattens space. And so you can get strange juxtapositions. And later on, the artist photographers really learned how to exploit that. But I just want to say right now, this is not cheating.
No, it absolutely is not. For any young artist wanting to be a painter, the use of photography is absolutely not cheating. And I think that we need to kind of embrace the technologies of today with the creative traditions. I think that's a must in a collaboration for any creative person. Yeah. I think that's really, really important.
Yeah, there's a very wonderful photograph in this exhibit by Thomas Eakins of his father-in-law, who's he's posed in front of a wall, and the tones are perfect, very, you know, different gray tonality and a dignified person. You could see the stand in which this is one thing that they had to do because the light took a long time to focus on the actual.
Yeah, the exposure times were very long.
Right.
Yeah, the shutter was open a long time, so you couldn't move.
You couldn't move. So he had to. So there's a stand. You can sort of see it propped behind him, and a little piece of it, which he actually used in the composition very nicely. It just points in the direction to the lower right hand corner, which really fills out the composition perfectly. And Egan's, he used photographs a lot, and he did a whole series of photographs of sort of young men cavorting at the swimming hole. And the photographs are, they're diving in, they're having fun. And then he transferred these photographs really pretty literally to compositions of a swimming hole. And somehow in that translation, they became something so solid and really timeless. Mm-hmm. And so looking at the photographs and the paintings is terrific. And Eakins really used a lot of photography in his work.
Even his watercolors have that kind of studied look, like you were looking through a camera. And they're kind of tight, somewhat stiff in some ways. But there was a definite bridge between his painting and his photography.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the only photo of his in the exhibition is really beautiful.
Yes, it is. It is. And then, of course, as photography went on, each one, there's such an interaction between photographers and painters. It just that each one influences the other until we get to the photorealists, Ralph Goings, Richard Estes, Audrey Flack. And they're making statements about modern mass production, but they don't deny their dependence on photographs. In fact, they use the effects of photography oftentimes, and they are copying perfectly the photographs that they took, and yet they're all different. The personality of each painter comes through. You would not mistake one photorealist painter for another, even though their process is the same. I do not understand it.
Yeah. That's a period of painting that I've always been a little bit troubled by, you know, drawing something from a photo so exactly like the photo. But, you know, it was a period post-pop, I guess, that was kind of really in.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I'm fascinated by it. I don't know why. One time I spent a little time with Ralph Goings, and that was the greatest time because he was photographing stuff for paintings, and I introduced him to our Dunkin' Donuts, which was not a familiar sight. It was a Southern thing, and he did a beautiful painting of the Dunkin' Donuts. It's in the Museum of Modern Art, I think.
Wow,
that's
a great story.
Yes,
there.
I know.
Nothing
I know.
Like a good morning coffee and a Dunkin' Donut to
right.
get us going. These works in the exhibition definitely do kind of bridge the painting. And I wanted to just talk about when you enter the exhibition, there's a number of photographs that actually look like drawings. You have to look really, really closely. And the staging and the subject and the environments had qualities that drawings have through the use of their values and tones. Value is the relationship between the lights and the darks. And looking at these early photos in the exhibition, I was particularly impressed by the subtleties of the tonalities and the values, because this was kind of hard to do with their big format, large format cameras. And it meant that the black, white, and grays were arranged so beautifully to really capture this believability in an important image. And these works look like drawing in a way which I'd like to introduce a sexy word in the morning, and that word is sfumato. And sfumato is a Latin word which means like smoke or being smoky.
WOWDLP Tacoma Park, 94.3 FM, community radio.
Some of the photos had this smoky quality, and you see this kind of smokiness in a Leonardo da Vinci drawing. Many artists that work finely in charcoal and charcoal dust or carbon dust are drawing that have this blending of shades and the fuzziness about the value distinctions in the depth of the drawings. And many of these early photos had this. I was thinking maybe these photos had this to do with the technical qualities of making the print and the mediums. And everything was experimental in those days. That's one of the things that we have to kind of understand.
Yes.
All these early photographs were just experiments. And the artists were trying to figure it out with a new medium and new materials. It was a lot of trial and error, and the work was laborious. It was actually dangerous, I think, some of these chemicals that they used. And lots of mistakes were made in getting the final great print. You know, we pick up our phones, you know, we snap away with that camera on our phones in a flash, and then we print them in a flash. That was not the case then. You know, we usually define new terms for our show, and this show has a lot of new terms. But I've got to say, Sheila, I was overwhelmed by
yeah.
all these new terms, and you know, we could breeze by them really quickly.
Yeah.
So I think we need to keep it short, because I was overwhelmed, because it was part chemistry. It was mind-boggling reading
yeah.
about all these chemical processes to get these photos. So what's a quick,
yeah.
really
well,
quick
well,
overview
there's,
here?
There's a photograph in the show, and it's a slice of a body. It's like I guess the best way to say it is if you took a body and froze it and made slices of it.
Yeah, there's two of them.
Right, there's two of them. And this is what you would see. And that is a cyanotype. And it's blue ink. It's printed in blue. And it's a chemical process that they also engineers use for blueprints. And so that I guess that I just want to say that was something that was used then, cyanotype. And I'm not going to describe it, because that's what it is.
Well, it gets so amazingly complicated when you read on, and there's the Ambro type and mm-hmm. these other types. But I think that these processes are easily available on the internet. I wish we had more time on the show, but it went on and on and on, and I was just lost after reading about all these things. This daguerreotype.
Yeah, that's really because that became for about 20 years the main process that photographers used, and it's using a glass plate with a kind of a mirror finish, And that's what was preserved in the photographs from the Wisconsin death trip. And they have a beautiful quality because they're the mirror quality of the plate is beautiful in itself.
Yeah.
And they could capture really beautiful darks and really sharp lights.
And details,
and
too.
Details.
It was amazing. These are, I think we need to tell our listeners that these photographs, if they're like 4 inches by, you know, 3 inches, it's a lot. And they're very, very interesting photos. It's something that we would, you know, ask you to study them in this case at the museum. Well, you know, one of the things, since these techniques of photography are part physics and chemistry, I think it's kind of for another expert, really,
to talk about. Somebody else.
I mean, do I have to admit to our audience that I got 2 C's and 2 D's in chemistry? Wow, not too good. So we're going to have to move on that. I'm not going to be talking about ambro types and all these other things. But I think we do need to understand that the platinum prints, the silver gelatin prints, they were all very, very, very important. I think it's time to take a little break. You're listening to WOWDLD Tacoma Park 94 LP Tacoma Park 94.3 FM. Let's listen to a song of the late 80s that my students turned me on to by The Cure, titled Pictures of You.
Tacoma Radio comes from Little Loft, a neighborhood art space for preschool, elementary, and middle schoolers. Located in downtown Tacoma Park since 2015, Little Loft offers classes, camps, workshops, parties, and open studio time. For more information, littleloftstudios.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Artist Experience on WOWDLP Tacoma Park 94.3 FM. And I wanted to talk about one thing, is that from the beginning of photography, it was seen as an alternative to traditional portraiture. And the clients knew that the image that they projected was going to be very important to them in life. And oftentimes, photographer's studios, they had costumes to wear, jewelry, so they could appear to be much more wealthy than they were. They had backdrops of elegant gardens, and the poses they would take would sort of, you know, the father with his brood, and the photographers would powder their faces and their hair and sometimes give them toxic concoctions to drink to make them pale. And most clients began to refuse the more uncomfortable and dangerous parts of the photographer's tricks. And so then they began to retouch the negatives. And so they could scratch on the negatives to bring out some highlights. And then there was a need for color photography, but that was very, very difficult to come by, to develop that, how to do that. And so there were a lot of hand tinting, hand painting, and the wealthy people could afford a really good hand tinter who could make the photograph be real. And if you didn't have a lot of money, you could maybe afford a little bit of a rosy tint on the cheeks or a little gold paint on the jewelry.
Yeah, that's the ones I'm used to. Anyway, well, you know, we have to dive into the exhibition, and let's leap into the works that come out of the painting, and there was quite a few. Why don't we begin with that?
Yeah, well, I've already mentioned Thomas Eakins and his portrait of William MacDonald, which is a fabulous portrait. There's also a photo by Clarence White, which is a portrait of Mrs. White in the studio, and he was a friend of William Merritt Chase. And there's something in this portrait that is very ghost-like, like the portraits sometimes of William Merritt Chase, of James McNeil Whistler. There is,
yes,
that quality,
totally,
to the photograph. It's really neat. And then Alfred Stieglitz, who was, everybody knows he was married to Georgia O'Keeffe, but he was a very influential photographer, and he made his 50-year career as getting photography and to be an accepted art form. He was very experimental. He had a New York gallery, which he introduced a lot of the avant-garde European artists to the U.S. And his photographs of Georgia O'Keeffe are everywhere, and they're fabulous. And they're also his own photographs, you know, of himself. It's great.
Yeah. An amazing technician, yeah, actually. Well, one of the things about those photos, there's a whole wall as you enter into the exhibition that they almost look like paintings, like of Thomas Moran or Albert Bierstadt, which echo the times of the landscape, what painters were doing then the photographers were doing.
Exactly.
In other words, they were piggybacking.
Back and forth.
Yeah, they
exactly.
were piggybacking each other, and
yes.
they had the grandeur and the vistas of this manifest destiny American West. Mm-hmm. So they were working in parallel to each other. And then we had this group called the Pictorialists, was a group mm-hmm. of international photographers who were looking at tones in the landscape and the environment, with gave a real very believable image of the landscape, like you said, something about this details. And they were bridging drawing and photography, and they really kind of got onto the world stage. There's a particular photo by Heinrich Kuhn, which is the portrait of his son, Walter Kuhn, mm-hmm. and from 1911. And this, when I first saw it, I thought it was a drawing.
It's a beautiful.
I had to put my nose practically to the glass mm-hmm. to see. It has the fuzzy quality. It's an awkward pose, which you would see sometimes even in drawing, but it's so powerful. And there's another one by the famous American photographer Edward Weston, Kneel Asleep, from 1925. And this comes out of, I mean, you know, those Oriental maidens lying on an Ottoman sofa, but this is Kneel sleeping. It's a kid. He doesn't have the elegance. He has actually the awkwardness, and it goes into a bit of that abstraction. I found those really very powerful photos,
mm-hmm.
and the details and the
yeah.
and the textures of the leather couch come out really really strong. One of the things about color, which you had alluded to before, there's really, if except for the Civil War portraits of the soldier that are hand-colored, there's only one other photo that I could remember by Cindy Sherman from 1983, and it's untitled. Yeah. And I have to tell you, Sheila, I thought about it when I left the exhibition. Mm-hmm. That photo really is out of place in this photo.
It really is.
And I know that she's an amazing photographer, but there's something... It's kind of like a bad selfie before selfies were even in.
It's true.
I mean, and so, and it's also large scale. It doesn't have the intimacy. It has the coldness that the others don't have. So, I don't know. That was a kind of an interesting curatorial choice there with the Cindy Sherman. That's the only photo I have to say that it left me with kind of an odd sensibility.
Yeah.
But why don't we move on to some really exciting stuff by Man Ray.
Sure. That's what I wanted to talk about, the electricity series. So this was a time when artists used photography to be experimental, not just to get the image, but to go beyond the image and see what they could do with the film itself, with the negative itself.
Right.
And Man Ray was a pioneer in this. And he was like his art, he was spanned painting, sculpture, film, prints. He was all over the place, poetry. And he was a Dadaist, a Cubist. he was great. But he really navigated the worlds of commercial and fine art. And that's a kind of interesting thing, because what is commercial art and what is fine art in this context? So he's remembered most for these photographs, which he called rayographs. And so there's one of his, I guess, partner, what we call now a partner, his lover, Lee Miller, who was herself a journalist and a beautiful woman. And then he sort of does this thing to make this kind of flashes of I don't know, like lightning across your body.
Yeah, there was somewhat sensual, and I found that they reminded me of, like, you know, remember the Frankenstein movies of the early 30s, which is coincidentally the same exact time that these photographs were done, and you know, the original Boris Karloff and Colin Clive as the mad monster. I got this sense of electricity shooting through the plane, like you saw when the monster was getting energized by the electricity. And I found it very coincidental that they were the exact same time. In other words, the new electricity is kind of new to the scene. So
that's true.
They're putting it into art, and they're energizing the space with these kind of, you know, bolts and shocks of electricity. And Man Ray did a beautiful job on those two photographs.
Yeah. And also Harry Callahan, who was another person, his pictures are modest, they're quiet, and he had his own private sort of enterprise of using photography almost like a drawing medium, so that he would draw on the photographs. He would take photographs of twigs, experiment with the negatives themselves. And one of my favorite photographs, which is not in this show, but it's very available and a lot of people have seen it by Harry Callahan, is of his wife, Eleanor. And I've seen this photograph many times. It's his wife, and it's just her head. She's in a lake. And she has dark hair, and her hair is dry. And you think, wow, how did her hair get dry in the middle of the lake? So it's sort of like a little bit, but you never really notice that, because the portrait, I hate this word iconic, but I'm going to use it here. It's an iconic photograph.
Okay, you're allowed. It's your show.
And also, I wanted to talk about Lee Friedlander, because there's a fabulous photograph of Lee Friedlander and his wife in their early days of their marriage.
In Los Angeles.
Oh,
that's
it's
a beautiful,
beautiful
photo,
photograph.
Yeah.
Two young people happily there. And one time, I spent a little time with Lee Friedlander. Man, he was amazing. Such a regular guy. Just a regular guy with a camera. Click, click. He clicked on everything. And he took photographs out the car window and in mirrors and everything he could do. And this particular photograph is when he was young with his wife. And there's a very poignant piece that was written and on the wall about a book that he did of his life with his wife. And when he gave it to her, he said that she could write about it. And she said, this is sort of a beautiful reminder of the good times they had together before their marriage sort of fell apart. It's really both. It's like what photographs can do, what I was talking about before, the past and the present and even in the future.
Yeah, there were three sensitive mm-hmm. photographs by Freelander in this exhibition. Mm-hmm. And one is kind of joyous, and as they proceed, you can see there's the tension in the photograph, but yeah. Yet they're you know, looking at the camera and all. I think it's a nice juxtaposition in there.
Yeah.
But one of the things also about the exhibition was a wonderful one photo, unfortunately, by James Van Der Zee from the Harlem Renaissance, who was a photographer from 1886 to 1983, and it's a picture of two African American couple, absolutely. Elegant is the only way I could put it. They're absolutely elegant. They're staring into. There's something proud about that photo. It's a wonderful photo, and I'm glad they included James Van Der Zee in this collection. And then we have Fame and Documentation by Brassai, the great Transylvanian via France photographer. And the portrait of Jean Genet is a wonderful portrait mm-hmm. in the exhibition. Jean Genet, boy, that was a tough guy. I mean, this guy was a prostitute, I mean, in and out of jail, a petty criminal, and then, of course, you know, a playwright and stuff. And it's really, really zeroes in on this guy. I mean, this guy was, you know, he looked rough.
He's my type.
And, oh, yeah?
Oh,
okay,
yeah.
Okay, thanks for sharing that one. Anyway, but it's an amazing photo with the stack of books behind him, which is really interesting. And then, of course, there's the great photo of Lucian Freud, the great British painter. And it's a double portrait. I think it might be the only double portrait. Oh, no, there are other double portraits. The James Van Der Zee one was, but with his model below him.
Yeah.
And then the painting in progress. It's a somewhat mm-hmm. interesting juxtaposition of the process of
right.
painting. And that's a wonderful photo. But Sheila, talk about that fantastic Brassai photograph
yeah.
of Picasso's
yeah.
hand.
You know, the strangest thing was it was in the exhibit, and I had just found a postcard of that in when I was trying to clean up my files. And the thing about photographs is you can stare as long as you want. And this is a plaster cast of Picasso's hand. And even though it's removed as a plaster cast, every detail of his hand is in this cast, and you can look at it and somehow having it be removed, you see Picasso in that hand. It's fleshy, it's strong, it's meaty, it's inelegant, and that's Picasso. It's
yeah.
him.
Yeah, you get that sense of that. It's somewhat powerful, and it conveys the personality as well. And every lifeline and
yes.
the little mark in the hand. That's yeah. an amazing photo. Again, you could look at it forever. We're kind of introducing some abstraction now with some.
Yeah.
So the exhibition
yeah.
is taking changing focus.
Yeah. Well, one thing I'd like to say, because I was talking about Lee Friedlander, that the thing Friedlander really got a handle on is what the camera does. It flattens things in space. And that the photograph that we were talking about, the Lucian Freud double portrait, is that it takes his wife, it takes his painting, and it puts them all in the same space so that it's like a real person and a photograph of a person, a painting, and he's in it. So,
nice.
So you... It and that's what Lee Friedlander really got is that you can make this incredible juxtaposition of things in a photograph. And so Aaron Susskind, he really got into abstraction. He would take pictures of rocks. He wasn't into the subject. He was into what he could do with that. And he would, say, drop out all the middle tones and just have the whites and the blacks and get a very powerful abstraction that would be like a Robert Motherwell or a Franz Kline. So right. He was right along there with the painters.
With the abstract, yeah. Well, there's a there's another group of photos by Marvin Newman on shadows in Chicago, which the abstraction of a shadow, that was really, really important. I'd like to really deal a little about this difference between photojournalism and the posed photograph. And we see some amazing photos by W. Eugene Smith.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That kind of introduces photojournalism. This is an important photo in the exhibit.
It does. It's of Albert Schweitzer, and Albert Schweitzer was a doctor in Africa. He played the violin. He received the Nobel Peace Prize. And he was this photograph of him in his office in Africa when he's pretty old, and it is the best portrait. I think it's probably, maybe I would say, the best photograph in the show, just as a portrait. It's terrific.
I don't know if I agree with you there, but it's but we'll talk about my favorite in another minute.
Yeah.
But there was the other wonderful of the W. Eugene Smith, The Waiting for the Survivors of the Andrea Doria from 1956.
Yeah.
Go ahead, talk about that.
Well, that's exactly where it is, photojournalism and art, because it's both, it captures the faces of the people as they're waiting. It's a very dark photograph. So it has the abstract qualities of a really well-composed photograph, but it's really an event that's happening right there.
Right, yeah, I invite our listeners to see the Robert Frank photos of the Welsh coal miners, and these are amazing photographs. My favorite of the exhibition, talking about photojournalism, was Ray de Carava's amazing photo of the Mississippi Freedom Marchers on Washington, D.C. from 1963. That is a showstopper. Uh-huh. The contrast and sensitivity of two African Americans, one a man who's out of focus and a woman on the left side of the photo, you go right up to her face, and she's actually beautiful, and there's an intensity about that, and it's an amazing juxtaposition of tonalities. It's dark, and yet it's so almost, it's like beaming. There's something that knocked me out. And so there were these, again, another photojournalistic look. But how about the Robert Frank photograph of 1956 of the two people that he surprised, the two African Americans on the hill in San Francisco? And it says, you know, you bastard, what are you doing?
Yeah, they're looking back at him.
Like, well, he just surprised them on the hill. And it's this white San Francisco. And these two African Americans in the foreground. It's an amazing juxtaposition. Mm-hmm. 1956, you know, in San Francisco, you know, it was a time where there was definitely caste in that part, even in San Francisco at the time. Well, you know, we're running out of time and we have to move on. It's a great show, everyone. And we're posing for the camera at the National Gallery of Art in the West Wing is a generous and strong collection of photographs from the Robert Menzel collection. We'd love to talk about selfies, but we'll have to save that for another show. We were just dying to get our listeners to hear about our opinions about selfies. But the beauty of the exhibition that we talked about really is a great overview, and I think you'll have great enjoyment for all of you listening. And then I'd like to say we have a few new shows coming up. Let's talk about them real quick, Sheila.
Yeah, well, we wanted to go to the Krieger Museum. It's been closed for renovations, but they've opened half of it. And that's a private museum in Northwest Washington. It's also got a beautiful sculpture garden. I've only been there once, but I'm dying for us to go.
Well, we'd like to thank Bobby and for his help here again today. And we're going to close with a song that kind of deals with the memories of what photography gives us. Thanks a lot and have a great day. And thanks for listening.
Photographs and memories, Christmas cards you sent to me, all that I have are these to remember you. Memories that come at night, take me to another time, back to a happier day when I called you mine. But we sure had a good time when we started way back when. Morning walks and bedroom talks are how I loved you then. Summer skies and lullabies, nights we couldn't say goodbye. And of all of the things that we knew, not a dream survived. Photographs and memories, all the love you gave to me, somehow it just can't be true. It's all I've left of you. But we sure had a good time when we started way back when. Morning walks and bedroom talks are how I loved you then.
And you just heard The Art as Experience in their new time slot every Saturday morning, alternating Saturday morning from 9 a.m. until 10 a.m. with Tom Zanakis and Sheila Reed. Wonderful program. They'll be back again in 2 weeks in their two new time slot. Current time is now 10 o'clock exactly, and you're tuned to WOWDLP Tacoma Park,